tell you a little bit today about how randomly triangulated surfaces can be used as models to describe many, I will not be able to describe all, properties of fluid and crystalline membranes. I mean, the first part of the talk will be essentially about crystalline membranes, the second part about fluid membranes. Now, to get started, let me tell you a little bit about biological membranes. I mean, one thing which happens, for example, in cells is endocytosis or exocytosis. So that's a process to transport material from the outside of the cell to some cell organelles, or vice versa. If you have some stuff which the cell doesn't need anymore, then it's transported to the plasma membrane and then expelled into the exterior of the cell. Now, this is a process which is obviously very important, and actually, I mean, only very small molecules can go directly through the membrane, such as water molecules or small ions. Everything else, all kinds of macromolecules, have to use this transport mechanism. Now, this is obviously too important for the cell in order to just kind of wait for a fluctuation for this to happen. So there is this controlled by proteins, and one of these, there are a few of these mechanisms, but one of them is by cathelin molecule. So the cathelin molecule is a rather large, complex protein, which consists of these three arms. And you can see when they attach on the membrane, they stick together in such a way that they form a hexagonal lattice. Maybe you can see it more easily here. Yeah, you can easily see this honeycomb lattice. And so first they attach almost planar on the membrane, but then there are some additional proteins which leads to curvature, and this is not really a time sequence, but this is just different snapshots taken at random, just kind of ordered in a sequence, so that you can get this impression that as it curves, it forms this butt, this transport vesicle. Now, in the cell, this is a rather complicated process because many proteins are involved, and I'm not even sure it's clear how many proteins are involved. But you can also do that in vitro. So this, for example, is such a two-dimensional network at some pH 7. And then if you change the pH, which is easy in vitro, not so easy in vivo, then you see that you get all these small buds, these small called micro cages, because you see that they consist only of a few of these networks. So it's kind of this of these cathelin molecules. So it's kind of a C60 atom of cathelin. Now, probably most of you know that the shape and fluctuations of membranes is controlled by the curvature elasticity, because if you think of lipid membranes, then the lipid molecules have a very small molecular solubility in water, so that essentially all the molecules which are in the membrane stay in the membrane. There are no ones coming, new ones coming from outside, and very few ones leaving. So therefore, the number of molecules just determines the size, the area, and therefore the surface tension cannot act to control the shape. And if you think of this as an expansion and curvature radii, then the next leading term beyond the surface tension, the surface area, is then the curvature elasticity, which is given here in terms of these inverse radii of curvature, which I've indicated to you here, and the Gaussian curvature. And there are three parameters in this model. Kappa is the bending rigidity. It measures how difficult it is to bend the membrane. C0 is a preferred curvature. If C0 is 0, the preferred state of the membrane is flat. But of course, you can have a preferred state where it curves preferentially to the upside, or of course, also to the downside. This is by this spontaneous curvature C0, and then we have Sutton's play modulus kappa bar.
So does the C now contain somehow the thermodynamics of the phases? Did you have different chemical potentials?
I mean,
sort of thing?
And this is not really an energy. It's of course a free energy, because I mean, you have to think of all the lipid molecules wiggling around and having interactions and so on. So this contains both molecular degrees of freedom and also, of course, energetic contributions. But MC0 has also, of course, has just an energetic contribution. Think of a molecule which has a big head group and a small or tail, then this would have a kind of a cone shape, and that would lead to spontaneous curvature in one direction. If you have a monolayer, in bilayers it's a bit more complicated, because if you have a symmetric bilayer, then you kind of whatever you do to the molecules on one side, you also do to the molecules on the other side. But you would have, for example, to have either different composition on one leaf of the bilayer than on the other leaf of the bilayer, then you also can have this kind of spontaneous curvature. All right. So now, if I now come back to this budding problem, then let's look first at a fluid membrane, because there this is rather easy to understand. So we consider a domain of some component A, which has a radius R, so maybe you can look here. In a membrane of some other component B, that this is stuff outside. And both of these components can be characterized by their own spontaneous curvatures, of course also by their own bending rigidities and so on. Here I've written it in this general form, so we have different bending rigidities, different spontaneous curvatures. And then of course, whenever you have a coexistence between two phases, then there is a energy line tension or surface tension you have to pay. So then this is last term here, which is the line tension along this phase boundary. Now if the, let's for example assume that these two curvatures, bending rigidities are the same, let's also assume that the outside has no spontaneous curvature, then one can rather easily calculate by assuming that on one hand we have to compare a state like this one, where we have a lot of line energy and little bending, and this state, sorry for the colors, I mean the black one should of course be here also in the bud, where we have a lot of bending energy but very little line energy. By equating these two energies, one gets such a relation, and I can derive that for you very easily in the case of zero spontaneous curvature. So say let's say CA equals C0 equals 0. Then we have in one case just a flat state. Here is the domain, and the energy of this one is 2 pi r times the line energy. And on the other hand, if this buds and we have a very little neck, then the energy of this configuration is the integral over the surface. Elasticity is k invariant, the result here does not depend on the radius. Right? And now if you equate these two, so we have lambda over kappa times r equal to 4, which is just the special case here that the spontaneous curvature vanishes. And then of course the spontaneous curvature kind of helps, because this makes this state a little bit more, makes this state more preferential and this one a little bit more costly, so that shifts this phase boundary. All right, so that was for fluid membranes. Now let's look at crystalline membranes. And if you look at crystalline membranes, there are at least two new features. One is that now the in plane you have shear modulus, whereas the fluid membrane, as its name says, I mean you pull on one side, you push on the other side, there's no, I mean there's a viscosity, but there's no elasticity. Here there is an elasticity, and of course in addition there is long-range crystalline order. And you certainly know that, I mean I cannot wrap crystalline surface on a sphere without creating defects, and the simplest case is the one shown here, that you generate 12 five-fold disclination, 12 vertices which have only 5 neighbors, whereas everybody else has, which you don't see, has 6 neighbors. So the question is then, in this budding transition, right, we start with a flat state, and we want to curve it into a sphere, how do these topological defects, these discriminations arise? Where do they come from? And there are two possibilities how they come into the vesicle. One is called the interior acquisition mechanism. So that is, you generate first a pair of dislocations. So that's kind of a 5-7, a pair of two disclinations, a 5 and a 7 is called a dislocation. And you can easily generate a pair of those dislocations. So you have a 5-7 and another 5-7, and they more or less cancel each other. And then you move one of those dislocations to the boundary, and then you also dissociate the two disclinations in the remaining dislocations so that only one of the 5 remains. The 7 also moves to the boundary, and then you have 1-5 somewhere in the interior. And then you do that 12 times, and then you have your sphere. Another possibility is exterior acquisition. You generate defects on the boundary, say dislocations, or it doesn't matter, and then just move the 5-fold dislocation into the center, and the 7-fold stays at the boundary. And then, of course, we want to see kind of how does the location of this budding transition change due to this crystallinity.
So that scenario is observed experimentally?
Sorry?
So it seems kind of conceivable that things like that would happen, but is that what people observe?
Well, experimentally, this is extremely difficult. I mean, extremely difficult to measure, to determine, because, I mean, as I said, I mean, for this graph thing, I mean, you only have snapshots. I mean, this is done by electron microscopy, so you have to freeze the membrane and prepare it in many different ways, and then at the end you get one picture. So it's very difficult to kind of.
So you can't make a cartoon.
But how about in crystals? I mean, does anything like this happen in actual in non-living crystals? There you have many more experimental techniques available, such as neutron scattering will pick up points of five-fold symmetry very easily. So does one see this?
Well, I mean, you would have to have a system where you can really kind of look at it as it's changing.
No, but that's easy with.
Okay, I'm not aware of an example. Okay, let's let's see. So I want to. I'm not sure of so many systems where you can really change the curvature radius. Okay, let's can talk about it later. I want to tell you now a little bit about modeling in the sense of doing computer simulations. And, I think like in all systems, there are different levels of description. And obviously, the most microscopic one is the atomistic description, where you think of atoms and Levy-Jones potentials and so on. So you describe the system as detailed as possible. Now, this is for realistic systems. This is only possible for something like 100 by 100 lipid molecules. So this is kind of far from this length scale where we can describe this budding of Catherine cages. You can go to a coarse-grain description where you kind of neglect some of these atomistic details and just describe, say, the lipid molecules as short polymer chains, a couple of identical beads which are connected to some other beads which have repulsive interactions, and then there are some water beads which you can also think of as kind of a couple of water molecules. This is still a complicated model, and for some purposes it's better to work with what's called solvent-free models. If you are not interested in dynamics or hydrodynamics, then all these water molecules, all they do is generate the hydrophobic effect, so they repel the tails from the water, and this repulsive interaction between water and the tails can be mimicked by just adding an attractive interaction between the tails. Now, but please note, I mean, also the number of degrees of freedom from here to here has been reduced a lot. The length scale is not that different after all, right? I mean, so this one chain here is still kind of visible. But if you want to go make a big step to make kind of a continuum description or kind of a discretized continuum description, then one can do is use these triangulated surfaces where, of course, you still have a kind of a network and a lattice constant, but this is not at all connected anymore to the size of the individual molecules. So as you already saw from my title, what I want to do is look at triangulated surfaces. And here's a somewhat better description of these triangulated surfaces. So we have a triangulated meshwork, which is kind of thrown on this surface. On each of the vertices, there's a hard sphere. And the main reason for the putting a hard sphere there for us was in the beginning to model self-avoiding surfaces. And then these vertices are connected by these bonds, and the bond is a tethering potential. That means the potential is zero if the tether is not stretched, and if it's stretched, the potential is infinite. So it's just a maximum distance between the vertices. So you have a minimum distance between all vertices, which is the hard sphere radius, and a maximum distance between vertices which are connected by bonds. If you make this tether length small enough, less than square root of 3 times the hard sphere diameter, then you generate self-avoidance because the holes in this network, these holes here in the network, are then too small to allow some other bead to penetrate. Right? So this kind of network for Fitts triangulation would describe what's called a polymerized membrane, and like a polymer, two-dimensional generalization of a polymer. If you want to describe fluid membranes, then we have to do something else. We have to make the triangulation itself a dynamic degree of freedom. And this is done by this dynamic triangulation. So the idea is very simple. I mean, you take some part of the network here, you select one of the bonds, this bond is removed from the network, and then a new bond is reinserted in this rotated fashion. And of course, that is only possible if the constraints that the tether length here is not, I mean, that the distance between these two points is not beyond the tether length.
Mm-hmm. Now, the grid that you have looks like a square grid that you have on the surface. Is that okay?
Sorry,
the grid that you have on the surface looks like that you actually have a square grid there, or a deformation.
Well, this could well be in this case, because this is how I drew it. But,
yeah, okay.
But of course, if you look at the other pictures, I mean, you will see that it's not a square network. This was just a little easier to draw by hand. Okay, so as I said, I mean, in the beginning we introduced these hard spheres just to have a self-avoiding surfaces, but then later we realized that this is actually also a very nice way to describe the transition from fluid to the crystalline phase. Because by changing the tether length, and this is for a two-dimensional network, for planar two-dimensional network, so that there's no other energy. There's no energy at all, because the tethering potential has no energy scale. So the only parameter is the tether length. And what you can do by changing the tether length, you change the in-plane density of your hard disks, and that is very similar to just increasing the density of a gas of hard disks. And it's a little different because you cannot generate kind of vacancies in this network, but I mean, otherwise the properties are very similar. And in particular, you can see that for a small tether length, you generate a crystal which has essentially no defect. You see two of these dislocation pairs. But if the tether length is a little larger, you see that there's an abundance of defects, and I can't remember, but I think this is already very close or in the fluid phase.
But is this really long-range order or quasi-long-range order?
Well, we have actually investigated that very carefully and tried to localize the crystallized transition from the crystalline to the hexadic to the fluid phases. And I mean, the model is too complicated to really study these crystallized transitions in detail. But what we can say is that it's consistent with two crystallized transitions with a very narrow region of the hexadic phase, which is, I think, at one point 4.8, but I mean, this what you see here is just the kind of a small lattice. In order to localize that, you really have to do finite size scaling and all this business.
But is there evidence of an actual crystal?
Yes. Yeah. Sure. But crystal, I mean, of course, I mean 2D. I mean, I'm not talking about Wagner. So of course, it's quasi long range order.
Oh, okay. That's what was worrying me.
The only truly long range order would be the bond orientation order.
Yeah. Sure.
Crystal.
No, I mean,
the crystalline phase has kind of quasi-long range.
So by crystalline, you mean the usual two-dimensional crystal, which isn't really, okay.
Well, the positional order is a little bit different. It's like, so we use this model now with a pattern length which is for 2D in the crystalline regime, and then we look at it at the shapes of membranes. So what we do is we take vesicle, and in order to avoid problems with periodic boundary conditions, so we take a vesicle, we take, when the red part is in the fluid phase, we take a large tether length for the red part, a small tether length for the black part, so that it's in the crystalline phase, and then we have a boundary here that this is characterized by this line tension, and then we change the line tension and you see that first the boundary is very rough, it's small line tension, then it smoothens at higher line tension, and finally closes into a small neck. And in our algorithm, there is no way for the vesicle to detach from the membrane because we kind of always require it to have a spherical topology.
In the real biological systems, is the line tension changing, or what is the other parameter changing?
Well, that's not really clear. I mean, I think it's not the line tension, but probably more the spontaneous curvature. But I mean, we have also changed them with spontaneous curvature. I'm just showing you here. This one measurement for the line tension. Because I mean, some of these other molecules, like endothelin, is one of these other proteins which are somehow involved in this rattling budding. And so it has been shown if there's no endothelin, then it just forms kind of shallow patches, but no, does not bud. So I think the reason is that when endothelium comes, it also kind of binds and generates this spontaneous curvature. It's unlikely that it's just kind of a surface active or line active molecule. Yeah. So here you see. So here you see, for example, the length of this domain boundary as a function of the scaled line tension. And this is for different spontaneous curvatures. And if you, the one with the lowest spontaneous curvature is this one. So you see, first it comes down because the fluctuations of the line tension, the thermal fluctuations of, not of the line tension, the thermal fluctuations of the boundary are reduced. Then it stays about constant. So the boundary is not changing much, not fluctuating a lot. And then suddenly there's a jump to almost zero boundary length, and this happens at a large line tension for spherical spontaneous curvature, and then as the spontaneous curvature increases, this goes down further and further. So this is for a domain with 92 vertices, and here is the same for a domain with 184 vertices. And from such kind of plots, we can construct a phase diagram by just localizing the point of the sudden decrease of the line length as a function of the spontaneous curvature and as a function of the line tension. And then you see that there's, again, roughly a linear dependence. So that's exactly the same as we had for the fluid domains. But now what was a constant before has a small tendency to increase as a function of the radius. Now, to somewhat get a somewhat better idea what's going on, let's take a look at how defects affect the shape of flexible membranes. And this is from a work of Soing and David Nelson about 10 years ago. So he studied what happens if you put a defect, so this is a five-fold disclination here in the center. If you put a five-fold disclination in the membrane, and look at it, compare once the planar state, so in that case you need a lot of stretching, obviously, or if you allow it to change its shape in three dimensions, and then you can have this kind of a buckled state, so like kind of a cone shape. And if you compare the energies of these two states, well, this has been calculated a long time ago, that the stretching energy of such a five-fold disclination goes like K0 is the Young two-dimensional Young modulus of this network times the radius squared. Whereas in buckling, this is easy to calculate if you assume that it's just a perfect cone, then this goes only well, it goes with the bending rigidity, but then only logarithmically in the radius of this domain.
But to the right, it doesn't look like a 5-fold explanation.
This one?
Yeah, to the left,
right.
I agree, there's one, but to the right, it doesn't.
This
look
one?
Like
one, two, three, four, five. Believe me. Yeah, it's a little bit difficult to see because I mean this line in the back is you can take a closer look later. So if you equate these two energies, and it's this is only a rough estimate, but somewhat it already shows that the radius has to scale like the bending rigidity divided by the Young radius to the 1/2. It's a little bit more complicated, of course, because this estimated perfect cone is not really correct in the vicinity of the transition. So this kind of result here follows from a more detailed calculation. And what you see is the buckling radius. So that's the radius, how large you have to make your membrane before it starts buckling. So that increases with increasing kappa, because if it's more and more difficult to you pay more and more energy for the buckle state, then you have to become larger and larger, and of course the inverse is true for the Young modulus. So from these kind of calculations, we can make the following prediction for different regimes, always by assuming that we compare on one hand the planar state and on the other hand just the perfect butt, which is not always a sphere anymore. So let's go through these different regimes. So the first regime is the spherical regime, that is when the bending rigidity is very high, so that the shape is a sphere, but then you still have to pay some energy for deforming your crystal onto that sphere, and then one finds that, so this is the bending energy contribution, then one finds in addition this stretching energy contribution. And this result here is consistent with what I showed you from the simulations before. It's difficult in the simulation to reach much higher values of this parameter here because, as you saw, it was difficult to really look at very large vesicles just from simulation point of view. And of course, a lot of the simulation time goes into the simulation of this fluid part, and we have only this relatively small butt. So therefore, we cannot really, in the simulations, go beyond this regime. But if you go larger, then it's well known essentially from the work of Tom Witten and collaborators, that if you go larger for fixed K0 and kappa, then the sphere shape starts to change, goes away from the spherical shape and approaches more and more icosahedron. Because effectively, the bending rigidity becomes less important and the stretching energy becomes more important. And of course, if you have only stretching energy, then the perfect the preferential state is just the perfect icosahedron, because you pay no energy for making these sharp creases at the connection between the boundary, between the corners. And what you see here, so with increasing this parameter, you find that looks like this, and if you go even higher, it looks like this, and so on. So you see that it approaches the icosahedron more and more. And from this one can distinguish several different energies. So what you see here is essentially the energy divided by kappa. First, there's this regime where these corners here can be very well described by cones. Therefore, one finds this logarithmic, as I've shown you, finds this logarithmic radius dependence. Then one goes into this regime where it's really icosahedron here with smoothed out edges, and then one finds this r to the 1/3 behavior. And then finally, if you go very large, then also David Nelson has shown that for a membrane which can fluctuate out of plane, that the crystalline phase is no longer stable and it's replaced by the hexatic phase. So for the hexatic phase, one expects again a logarithmic. Yeah, so you see then one finds a rather complicated behavior of this phase boundary, which we can only partially check by simulations. And in particular, the budding of these crystalline domains is really expected to be very different from the behavior of fluid domains, which would just have gamma equal to 4.
Can I ask a question about the previous slide? I mean, the energy is com- is it is the energy a complex function of the positions of the individual nodes or not? I mean, are you assuming some sort of a quadratic potential, or do you have more complicated?
I mean, we have this tether potential,
and
which is can think of as a kind of an entropic spring.
Mm-hmm.
So the particles have cost, it costs no energy for the particles to move between touching and maximum tether length,
mm-hmm.
but you can just replace it by harmonic potential, which is fine.
Because if the energy is convex, then I don't know how you can change from one type of minimizer to another in a discontinuous way. That's what I don't know.
Oh, this is not, no, this is not discontinuous. I mean, this is kind of a smooth function. And you just, I mean, you, so this is a function which looks like.
So the buckle state kind of emerges out of the flat state, is that what you're saying?
So I mean, if you've, I mean, you can also see that here, right? I mean, first it's almost circular. I mean, circular. Then it's almost circular. Then you go a bit further, and you see that these kind of facets appear. And then if you go even much higher, then you see the facets become more and more pronounced.
Considering the second point, I want to look at that there is no elastic energy associated with the force between two poles. Is what you said?
For some reason, which I don't understand, is that a state roughly in this regime can be very well described, and the energy which you determine numerically can be extremely well described by just assuming that it's 12 cones.
And no energy associated with the force?
I don't understand it, but it's just the observation. And it's also surprising, right? I mean, if you look here, then, I mean, of course, there are already appreciable deviations from the cone, but in this regime, it's very well described by cone, by this cone energy. Okay, I have no insight into this. It surprises me very much. Oops. Okay, so now I want to show you the dynamics. And I mean, this is one of the advantages of the simulation, that we can also look at the dynamics. So we start with this almost planar domain, and it's without any defects. Then we waited a little while, and we see that after some Monte Carlo steps, defects do appear. All the defects appear on the domain boundary, so that is a clear indication for this exterior acquisition mechanism. Then these defects migrate into the interior, and around here you see that you have kind of a half sphere, and then after the half sphere has formed, it closes very quickly. We can also look at this, try to reproduce these microcages, which I've shown you in the beginning, and to do that we take a very high spontaneous curvature. Clearly we want to make small buds, so we need a high spontaneous curvature, and in order to avoid that we can generate all kinds of defects in the interior, we take a very high Young release, that this means it's very difficult to generate defects in the interior. And then this is again kind of a time sequence. So what you see is first it curves down on the boundary, because there it's not so much restricted. And then at the corners, spherical regions form. They form more. You see here that we have these almost spherical buds, but then and this is very close to what is seen in one of these experiments. But then of course it's not stuck in this state, but it's kind of curves more and more until it's all small.
So with your test and model, how do you generate how do you put the spontaneous curvature?
I have not told you. So I've not told you how I discretize the curvature energy. But I mean, of course, I do not only take just the bonds and the beads, but in addition, I have to add a bending energy, or discretized bending energy. And I mean, that's a little complicated. I can tell you how it's done, but I mean, I think it's
close behind.
Yeah. All right, so let me just summarize this first part. I've shown you the budding of crystalline domains, and defects are generated on domain boundary, diffused in the interior. This is this exterior acquisition mechanism, and yeah, there was some other hypothesis that for this, in this case, the spontaneous curvature at the transition is no longer decreasing function of the radius, but an increasing function. But I mean, if you take this function gamma of r, which I had, and divide, and which is an increasing function, divide by r, then you find that in the end, gamma of r over r is always decreasing. So as in fluid membranes, the spontaneous curvature and line tension at the transition are decreasing functions of the radius. And as I mentioned briefly, in this graphene controlled body, there are other proteins, and one is this endothelins I mentioned, and I think even from an experimental point of view, would be very interesting to understand in more detail how they kind of fit into this mechanism, which is, assumes that there is this change for spontaneous curvature. But of course, one would like to know from a biological point of view how this spontaneous curvature is generated.
Okay. As far as I can see, you have no inertia, right? And so
no, there's no inertia.
Is this a good approximation? Not a reason to neglect inertia?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, first of all, it's always in a fluid, right? I mean, the membrane lives in water, or maybe not in water, but I mean, in some viscous medium, so it will take, I mean, there will be friction, viscous friction. And in addition, of course, this is a rather slow process. I mean, if you think of how proteins rearrange and so on, I mean, this is slow. So I don't think that inertia plays any role. Yeah, so I wanted to point, I completely forgot to point out here, that of course you see that there are quite a lot of defects, and that it's not just the few 12 dislocations which appear, but disclinations which appear, but in addition there are a lot of other defects, dislocations, and in particular here that you can see that there's a line of such dislocations. And so this is what I want to briefly discuss in the next two transparencies. Now, Mark Wovig will certainly tell you more about this tomorrow, but he and David Nelson and some other people have discovered a few years ago that on spherical surfaces, the state of minimal elastic energy is not just kind of a deformed icosahedron, but that you can reduce the elastic energy by forming these lines of dislocations, or what they call defect scars. And what they found is that this scar length depends linearly on the sphere radius.
So what do these points represent? I mean,
this is again the 5, 7, 5 and 7 coordinated vertices. Yeah, you can think of this as a brain boundary, because you can describe brain boundaries as a sequence of dislocations.
But are these lines essentially charge neutral? They're not.
Well, they have one extra.
Yeah, one extra. But I mean, essentially.
One extra five-fold disclination.
The charge plus one.
Okay, but they don't. The charge doesn't scale with them in any way.
They're like delocalized disclinations.
Mm-hmm.
The charge is essential.
But they are finite charge, independent of R.
Right.
So we see, I mean, we saw in this simulation picture that some evidence that these defect scars appear, but again, I mean, these were rather small spheres. So we wanted to look at this in a little bit more detail. Therefore, we have looked at this not for this budding geometry, but just look at one sphere, just one crystalline sphere, and then see what happens with the defects. Here you see two simulation results, and this is now much bigger. I think this is something like 2,500 vertices, and this is about 10,000 vertices. And you can see, for example, here, that there are, again, these defect lines. But you have to see that also in this case, which is almost spherical, that we simulated a finite temperature, whereas these other calculations of Mark were at zero temperature, which is energy minimization. So now, as I've indicated, one of the previous transparencies in these flexible surfaces without defects, we find this transition from spheres to icosahedra, this faceting with increasing Fabre von Karman ratio. This is this number which appeared several times. Now the question is, what happens if we include the defect scars? And what you see here from the simulations, this fasting still happens. And this is also what I assumed in my estimates for the budding transition. So faceting still exists, but if you look at this picture and in this picture, it seems that the lines here are not much shorter than they are here. And so the defect scars seem to get localized for sufficiently large Fokker van Kammer number. And as I say, I mean, the scars get more fuzzy. They are no longer just straight lines at finite temperatures. Now we can make that a little bit more quantitative by plotting here the number of defects, the number of dislocations per topological declination. And then you see that first it increases linearly as predicted, and then it separates. And the same is true for different bending rigidities. The higher the bending rigidity, the further it, the longer it increases linearly until it separates. For small bending rigidity, it increases only a little bit and then already separates. And we can understand that by the following simple argument. I mean, these defect scars screen the deformation field if there is Gaussian curvature. I can explain it to you afterwards, but let's just assume that for the moment. But on a planar surface, you gain nothing by adding a scar. So therefore, as the size of the vesicle increases and it becomes faceted, the scars are, quote, expelled from the planar or cylindrical region, then they're confined to the corners. And the radius of the corners is essentially given by this buckling radius. Because that's the first time when you deviate from the spherical shape. So you can think of this curvature at the corners being frozen at the point where it starts faceting. Yeah, so that implies that if you plot the length of these scars divided by the radius as a function of radius over buckling radius, then we should get kind of a scaling curve, and that what you see here. So all these data here collapse onto this one curve if you plot it scar length over radius as a function of the Fokker van Kammer ratio, which is number which is just the square of this ratio here. And by the way, this value here, the straight line here in the beginning, that is exactly has exactly the same slope or exactly the same value here as predicted by Mark Hovig and David Nelson. All right, I have probably almost no minutes left, but let me anyway tell you a little bit. Let's rush through the remaining transparencies. The second half of my talk, which is now the second, the last 5% of my talk, is about hydrodynamics, so we can also do hydrodynamics with these surfaces. Let me just give you a quick idea. So this is, for example, interesting if you want to look at the flow behavior of vesicles or the flow behavior of red blood cells. This is an artistic view. Here you can see the red blood cells moving in a narrow capillary in vivo. And this is, for example, interesting to study for us because we can easily vary the bending or elastic parameters. Because in diseases such as diabetes or malaria, the deformability of the blood cell is reduced. And this is one of the bad consequences we have when you get some of these diseases, because then the heart has to do a lot more work. So we want to combine these triangulated surfaces with a method to describe hydrodynamics. And this is a complicated problem in general in soft matter or complex fluids, because there's a big length and time scale gap between the atomistic scale of the solvent and the mesoscopic scale of these dispersed particles. I mean, that can be typically several orders of magnitude. And therefore, several different mesoscopic simulation techniques have been developed in order to bridge this gap. And the basic idea is always the same: to drastically simplify the dynamics on the molecular scale, because if you really want to have hydrodynamic behavior on the scale of microns, then you don't have to care about the dynamics on the angstrom scale. But we have to respect the conservation laws on mass, momentum, and energy in order to make sure that we automatically generate hydrodynamic behavior on sufficiently large scales. Well, I mean, there are several of these methods available now, and I think they have all reached a somewhat mature status. I mean, probably have heard about that, Boltzmann dissipated particle dynamics. The method we are using is called multiparticle convolution dynamics or stochastic rotation dynamics. Okay, let me quickly explain this method. It consists of two steps. We have point particles which move in the continuum, so it's an off-lattice method. And in the streaming step, we just have a ballistic motion of the particles for some time step h. And then there's a collision step. And in the collision step, particles are sorted into boxes. And all particles which are in the box collide. And they are kind of collide by definition. And there are different rules how to generate these collisions. The simplest rule, and this is why it's called also stochastic rotation dynamics, is one subtracts the average momentum of all the particles in the cell from each particle. Then one rotates all the relative velocities, and then one adds the average velocity, average momentum back onto all these particles.
But rigidly?
It's a rigid rotation, yeah. So all the velocities are rotated by the same angle. Then there's a way to kind of satisfy or guarantee Galilean invariance by doing random shifts, but let me jump over that for the moment. And then one nice thing about this one, can use kinetic theory kind of generalized to this finite range of interactions to calculate transport coefficients. For example, one can calculate the kinetic and collisional contribution to the kinematic viscosity. And these are rather simple expressions which can be derived. And you see here a comparison of this analytic theory, which is the red line, with some simulation data. And the agreement is extremely good. Okay, so we use this method now to, and we combine this method now with a randomly triangulated surfaces. And let me not go into the details, just want to emphasize here that we can apply no slip boundary conditions on the surface of the membrane. And as an example, which I want to show you, is vesicles and cells in capillary flow. So here you have a cylindrical capillary, and on the left-hand side, this is a picture for small fluid flow velocities. We take here a vesicle, a fluid membrane, which has a volume inside, which is less than the volume of the sphere, in such a way that it has this discocyte shape. As you see, it's a discocyte. You can have this top look from the side and look from the top. But then as the velocity increases, we find a transition to this prolate shape. And the reason is that for this particular volume, these two shapes are almost degenerate in their energy. So a little push by the fluid, which has here this parabolic flow profile, generates this elongated cigar shape. Interesting is that here for the small flow velocities, the discocyte is not oriented in such a way that its coaxial, the symmetry axis is coaxial with the capillary, but it's rotated in this 90 degree fashion. Okay, now if you do the same for red blood cells, you have to take into account that the red blood cell, which you see here, has also this discocyte shape, has in its interior attached to the membrane, again, a protein network, called spectrin network, and this spectrin network gives elasticity to the membrane, shear elasticity to the membrane. We model this by attaching two networks together. So we take our network of randomly triangulated, dynamically triangulated network, and attach to it a network which is also random in the sense that it has no regular order, but it's fixed. So no tether flux in this other network, which symbolizes the spectrin network. And then what you find is, well, for small flow velocities, essentially the same, but at high high flow velocities, we see that there are these, is a new type of shape, what is called a parachute shape. And actually, the shapes which Hans Hermann showed yesterday, reminded me somewhat of these parachutes, except that they are oriented the other way around. So, I mean, these ones move with their tip to the front, whereas in the other case they move in the wrong way. And here you can see an experiment of red blood cells moving in glass capillary, and you can very nicely see these parachute shapes. Okay, here, let me not go into the details. So this is how this critical velocity where the transition from the from the discocyte to the parachute happens depends now on the bending rigidity and on the shear modulus, and we can use this to extrapolate values for red blood cells, and we predict that this transition rate velocity for red blood cells should be about 1.2 millimeters per second for a capillary radius which is a little larger than the radius of a red blood cell, and that is in reasonable agreement with the experiment. So the last thing I want to show you, and I'm sorry that it took a little longer, is a movie. What I showed you so far about red blood cells was just one single red blood cell. Of course, in blood, there are much more red blood cells. Actually, the hematocrit, that's the volume fraction of red blood cells in the blood, is 45%, except if you are a professional bicyclist, then it's a lot higher. So it's interesting to study the hydrodynamic interaction between red blood cells, and this is what I want to show you now. So this is now three red blood cells. So the hematocrit is still pretty small. The flow is in this direction. I will run it now, but don't be confused. It's a kind of a co-moving frame. So the camera is moving with a red blood cell, and it's always fixed to one red blood cell. So if these are moving backwards, it doesn't mean that something is moving in the wrong direction. So you see first that there's a pretty stable state where these three red blood cells are moving as a cluster together, and then sometimes by thermal fluctuations one of them is kind of expelled from the other ones, and this one is moving a little faster than the two remaining ones because it can be deformed by the flow forces more easily, so it's more in the center of this parabolic flow and therefore it moves faster, so that's again a little different than in the case of sanctuaries, probably not too surprising. Okay, then let me come to. Okay, so let me come to my second summary. So I didn't really have much time to convince you that mesoscale simulation techniques are a very powerful tool to bridge this length and time scale gap in complex fluids. Maybe I succeeded anyway. This method is particularly well suited to look at embedded particles like membranes, which I've told you about, but also colloids or polymers. And what I've shown you is, as an example, is this vesicles in flow where we would see these parachute shapes and the hydrodynamic interaction between vesicles. Well, thanks a lot.